Hey guys, I just wanted to let you know that this podcast is presented by mybookie.ag, and that if you use the promo code MATTEK, M-A-T-T-E-K, that you will get a 50% deposit bonus on your first deposit. And given that you are a listener to this podcast, I would assume you're relatively knowledgeable about sports, and I would trust you to try your edge on the online sportsbook. You can lay down some money and get in on the action at one of the safest online sportsbooks in the world. It's the only one that I am currently using. You can wager on all sorts of different outcomes on mybookie.ag, soccer, football, any major league, esports. You can even create your own player props, which is useful for me because if you know anything about me, I do enjoy a good player prop. So if you deposit using the promo code MATTEK, M-A-T-T-E-K, you get a 50% bonus when you deposit. And I will add this for listeners of the TakeCast. If you deposit using the promo code MATTEK and you send proof of it to me on Twitter, I will follow you on Twitter and you can have access to me via DMs whenever you want. That's the TakeCast bonus that I'm adding in association with the mybookie.ag deposit bonus. Now let's get back to the show. Hello everyone, would like to welcome you to the TakeCast. My name is Davis Matic. You can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. This week, a really interesting show with two of my Twitter buddies from Seattle. An interesting discussion about the Seattle Seahawks, NFL roster construction, expected value added, how to build an NFL roster, all sorts of really good and interesting stuff with Ben Baldwin from The Athletic and Danny Kelly from The Ringer. I think you guys will really like the conversation that we had over the course of about 45 minutes to an hour. And of course, please leave a rating and review on iTunes if you would be so kind. The reviews have slowed down. I'm not going to lie to you guys. You're slacking a little bit, which kind of bums me out. I really want to get on the new and noteworthy page. That would mean a lot to me and would be very helpful if you guys could do that. So without any further ado, let's get into the show. Daily Roto is a mostly proud sponsor of the TakeCast, a mostly sports podcast. TakeCast listeners can save 10% at Daily Roto with the promo code JANIS, J-A-N-I-S. If you are playing on DraftKings or FanDuel, Daily Roto will help you improve your daily fantasy results this fall and save time in the process with lineup optimizers, ownership projections, fantasy projections, premium content, and much more. They have all the good stuff that you want to help you make money at sports betting and daily fantasy. Their new lineup optimizer will let you build optimal GPP teams with stacks based on their projections faster than I can punt money off betting on Peter Uihlein. Sure, you can play the guys that I recommend each week, but shouldn't you also get advice from a proven daily fantasy winner like Drew Dinkmeyer? Yes, I do have better hair than Drew, but I also have his cell phone number, and that makes me a winner almost as much as it makes him a winner of the DraftKings Millionaire Maker. And it's not just fantasy. They have tools to bet on player props, golf matchups, and a customizable NFL game simulator for this fall. Head over to dailyrodeo.com/premium and save 10% with promo code JANIS today. All right, everyone. Joined by Ben Baldwin from The Athletic and Danny Kelly from The Ringer to talk some football. This is not going to be a more classic TakeCast. This is going to be pretty football-centric. Not going to talk much about the downfall of Western civilization or anything like that. Ben, you also are noted number one fan of the show. How does it feel to be welcomed onto the TakeCast?
It's pretty wild. You usually ask guests how many podcasts they regularly listen to, and I don't listen to that many, but this is one of the ones that, like, if there's a new episode, I definitely listen to. So it feels pretty good to be on the show, actually, even though I'll be ruining it with the sound of my own voice.
That's such high praise, because I probably have like 25 podcasts on my feed, but only like five of them get automatically listened the day that they come out. So that's pretty high praise. Danny, of course, welcome to the show. And also, how many podcasts do you listen to?
I have like a rotating list of probably like six or seven that I listen to, not like every time. So I kind of just like randomly will get interested in certain, you know, specific things and then go from there.
There we go. Perfect introduction to the show. A big reason why I wanted to have you two on together, because most of the time I just kind of have one person on and we get really into whatever it is that they're really good at. But I wanted to have you two on together because I've always thought of the Seahawks as really being at the forefront of several discussions going on in football. The first being that winning a Super Bowl is so much easier when you have a good quarterback on the rookie wage scale, because Russell Wilson was really the first example of that after the rookie wage scale changed. And also, even if the front office was not necessarily super into analytics, for whatever reason, Seahawks fans on Twitter were really into analytics. Like, they were always proud of winning the DVOA championship. Like, that was a big thing that Seahawks fans were like proud of. And so a couple questions for you guys. You know, what is the outstanding lesson to learn from the Seahawks, you know, from the Super Bowls to, you know, now drafting Rashad Penny in the first round? You know, did they look a gift horse in the mouth? Was trading first for Percy Harvin and Jimmy Graham? Like, just like, what is the lesson overall to be learned from the Seahawks of the last 6 years, Ben?
I think if I had to just put it down as one lesson, it's that you can't be consistently good if you just have one or two good ideas, because inevitably those are going to be stolen. So if you think about what the Seahawks were good at, they identified having this defensive system and having long cornerbacks, and then probably also the spark stuff where they were using this measure of athleticism. And it seemed like the Seahawks were at the forefront of that. But then once a bunch of other teams caught on, then there's not really any competitive advantage there. So the question is how you contain consistent competitive advantages in a league where everyone else can steal your ideas. And it looks like the Seahawks are not really doing that. We can talk about the reasons why, but whatever the reason, that's not really what's happening.
So yeah. Danny, one of the reasons that, and I actually just thought of this while Ben was talking, is that style of cornerback has to be less effective than ever now, given all the rule changes like the last like 3 to 4 years.
Right. I mean, yeah, when you think about it, like the Legion of Boom era, just picture how much the Seahawks were, you know, however you want to like say it, getting away with or whatever. Because I know that they did a lot of studying of referees and how much they called and things like that. So there was like methodology to it. But if you think back to the time, like the Seahawks Niners games back in the day, like there was so much hand fighting, so much physicality, you know, all that stuff. Like, remember Brandon Browner? He would like body people on every play. And yeah, I mean, I think you're right. The NFL changed. They tried to make that less of a part of, you know, obviously the rules change in favor of the offense almost every year. So, I mean, as Ben was saying, like that competitive advantage definitely, you know, had its moment, but it doesn't seem to be a big factor now. And, you know, even if you look at some of the way the Seahawks play now, like they're not pressing it nearly as much as they used to, I don't think, or at least it's not the same style of press as they used to. And so, I think in the NFL, you have to adapt to the times and adapt, you know, to what teams are doing to, you know, counter what you're good at. And when Ben was kind of running down like his overall 30,000 foot take, my kind of impression was like, on one hand, you really like to have a team that has a very specific philosophy and you know, like plan. Cause like, I think there are NFL teams that definitely don't even like have a real defined plan. But on the other hand, you have to be able to evolve and you have to be able to change, you know, and kind of with the way that the rules change and the league has changed and your personnel changes, especially. And I kind of like with Ben, like this doesn't seem like the Seahawks are going in the right direction anymore, but yeah, we'll see how that all works out this year.
So how much of this would you level on no real good offensive coaches being used with Russell Wilson, Danny? Like just like from a play level, have they had any offensive coordinator or even assistant or quarterbacks coach who really was doing innovative things with stuff that Russell Wilson can do that no one else can do?
I think when you look back at I think it was the 2012 season, like midway through, they started doing the read option a lot with Russell Wilson. I think that was a huge amount of the success the Seahawks had from 2012 to 2013. it's not the only thing that they did well, but they really maximized what Wilson was able to do. And paired with Marshawn Lynch, they had like one of the most dangerous rushing attacks in the NFL because they could do so many things off of the read option. You know, there was a lot of where they didn't even have an actual read. They were just handing it off on some plays. They had Wilson run on some plays. They worked play action off of that. There was just a whole lot of things that they could do out of the read option. They don't really do that anymore. So I think early on, I think they did do a good job of kind of like maximizing what Wilson was really good at. But I would say over the last few years, the Seahawks don't particularly strike me as a team that is cutting edge in any way in terms of what they did on offense. It was just kind of the same old stuff that everybody does, you know, and I think it's a little bit telling that Daryl Bevell doesn't even have a job at this point. You know, it didn't seem like they were pushing the envelope in anything. And so, yeah, I wouldn't say that, you know, I think there's been some jokes on Twitter lately because Pete Carroll has called the offense sophisticated. I don't really see it.
It's a high-tech offense where the word's used.
We'll see. I haven't noticed anything. Like, I mean, it's just a stark difference when you watch, like, say, the Rams or the, you know, the Shanahan offense or even the Doug Peterson offense. And it's just a huge, huge difference between what they're doing and what the Seahawks are doing.
Well, right now, Ben, would you say the biggest competitive advantage is offenses that make it easy for the quarterback to do the quarterback's job?
Yeah, in terms of things that you like actually have control over as a team. So like from a high level, the biggest competitive advantage is probably having a good quarterback on a rookie contract. But if you don't have that, like the Seahawks don't.
So if that's the number one, what's the second? Because everyone knows that now. I think that even like casual, you know, like NFL guy who just watches his home team knows good quarterback, rookie contract. So if that's number one, Ben, what's the number two biggest competitive advantage right now?
Yeah, I think number two would be having an offense that puts your quarterback in a position to succeed. And we saw that with the Eagles. Nick Foles probably isn't as good of a quarterback as we saw during the NFC Championship game in the Super Bowl, but they had a lot of really interesting concepts and simplified things for him and took his input in plays that he was comfortable running. And it really seemed like a collaborative process where they did everything in their power to say, this is our quarterback. Quarterback's really important. So how can we tailor our offense around what he likes to do and what can place him in the best position to succeed? And it seems like a lot of teams do not do that. They have this specific philosophy about their system or what they want their offense to look like and try to shoehorn everything into that. And that seems like probably not the best idea.
So before we move on to more high level stuff, not just specific to the Seahawks, I need to know your favorite moment from the Percy Harvin era in Seattle. Either one of you, just if you could give me, you know, some sort of recollection of that magical time.
Oh, well, obviously the Super Bowl return, he had a kickoff return to start the second half of the Super Bowl, the first Super Bowl that they were in, 48. That was probably the high point. I do remember a few weeks there where it was super exciting that they were using him in jet sweep stuff, and that was, like, confusing the hell out of defenses. We saw it in the Super Bowl, too, actually. Like, they picked up some chunk plays with that. Yep. So there was some stuff that I liked, but obviously, like, the other stuff was, you know, not to use a pun, but it was a total headache.
Oh no.
Oh my gosh, I forgot that was his deal. I kind of forgot that was like the weekly, like you didn't know if he was going to play because he had migraines.
Right. He had a whole bunch of different stuff. The first day he got to Seattle, he had like a hip thing and then he had to get surgery. So that was great.
Yep.
You know what's wild is he was just, I'm looking at his Pro Football Reference page right now. He was completely just Jarvis Landry before Jarvis Landry.
He was
just like slot.
Actually, like, good for a little bit.
Like he had 121 target season where he didn't break 1,000 yards. He ran more than Landry ever did. But like, I just happened to like be looking at Landry stuff last week. And this is like the exact same. Kids these days, they don't even know. If you didn't play fantasy football in like 2012, you have no idea. What were you even talking about?
There was like the thought, and I remember cause it was all kind of pie in the sky at first. And I wrote about it a couple times, but like there was the thought that he would be able to be this Alvin Kamara-esque player for them. And I think his physical profile, you know, he was actually pretty explosive runner out of the backfield. And
he's actually bigger than Kamara is even too.
So there was like this theory that he could be that. And I think physically he could have been, but the injuries. And then I think the Seahawks didn't really have a specific plan. See, that's the thing. And the Seahawks have done this with a couple different players. It didn't feel like they had a specific plan to like cater their offense to them. They wanted to bring him. They wanted to bring Jimmy Graham in and like make him a part of their offense rather than tailoring their offense around these like supremely talented players. And so, but that's just, you know, years and years of failed trades for the Seahawks kind of catching up with me.
If you had to guess how old Percy Harvin is right now, today, September 17th, how old would you guess, Danny?
28.
Dude, he's 30 years old.
30. Wow. I mean, he could still be playing pretty easily.
He could easily. He should at least be in the CFL.
Right.
I'd watch that. So continuing the conversation about quarterback play, Danny, I know kind of from more like an all 22, a grinding the tape level, you will have hopefully have a pretty good answer on this. But, you know, something that like you can't turn on the TV, you can't read any football coverage without people talking about how many points there are being scored, how good the quarterbacks have played. Like there are, you know, Sam Bradford and Josh Allen who look like they don't have a clue, but you know, Ryan Fitzpatrick career year, Darnold coming out firing right away. Andy Dalton has 6 touchdowns in 2 games. And just like from an arm talent level, like these guys, they're okay. They're not great. So from an actual play level, what do you see that coordinators are doing different? Is your explanation entirely defenses are worse, the rules are tilting even further, or is play calling actually better?
I think it's a confluence of events, not to be like a total fence sitter, but I think number one, obviously it helps that most teams are pretty healthy right now. Like if you look at last year, there was just so many injuries to everywhere, to like star players. And so that definitely made, I guess it makes it a bigger contrast compared to this year. I do think that right now, you know, we had 18 offensive coordinators change, or I should say there are 18 new offensive coordinators in the NFL this year or play callers. And there's also, I want to say like 2 or 3 guys that were elevated from interim status. And so it feels to me, and I haven't like studied all 22 of every single team this season, but it feels to me like a lot of what's happening is these huge numbers of turnover is helping teams get, you know, they're more open to some of these spread concepts that we're seeing. They're more open to trying to manipulate space and things like that. And I think obviously the NFL is still very much like a quote pro style league, but there's a lot more elements of that offense getting integrated in. And I also think that part of that, it might early on right now, especially part of it might be like teams don't really have a book on a lot of these teams because there's so much turnover. You don't really know what to expect.
Yeah. No one's got Patrick Mahomes film right now.
Right. And I mean, like for instance, like the Bucks, you got Todd Monken who took over play calling and kind of like adapted that offense. He's got so much talent in that offense. And we're finally seeing someone be able to kind of harness it. And obviously I don't think it's going to happen like that all year round, but I mean, I was looking at the Buccaneers first couple of games on the schedule when you're facing the Saints and then, oh God, who did they play this week? I can't even remember. Oh, the Eagles. And I'm like, wow, that's easy 0-2. And they just freaking destroyed them. And so I don't know. It's just one of those things where I think there's a confluence of events. You got healthy guys, you've got play callers willing to cater their systems more around their personnel in terms. And I think a big part of it too is the offensive line play hasn't really necessarily improved, but the ball's coming out faster, things like that.
I actually think the offensive line play, and this is from, I'm a very casual observer of offensive line play, but it seems quite a bit better to me.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah, I mean, and again, that goes to the health. I think if you look around the league, there was kind of a lot of shuffling of offensive line. For instance, the Bengals had one of the most atrocious offensive lines in the NFL the last 2 years. They traded for Cordy Glenn. They drafted a guy in the first round. You know, they got a lot better depth and they got a new offensive line coach. And so we're seeing, I think, some of the effects of that with their offense too.
So Ben, this is actually probably something that's come up in your research, but my guess as to part of why point scoring is up so much, because people actually forget this, points were down last year from 2016. So if you did a comparative analysis from 2016 to 2018, I don't actually think it would look that different. But last year, what a bunch of these bad offenses were doing was they were just passing it really short. There was a lot of like 4-yard passes, 6-yard passes. And my assumption is that, and what you have probably found, is that more teams are throwing the ball deep more often. Is that wrong or is that right?
So I haven't looked at it this year, which I definitely should. But yeah, it's absolutely the case that the further downfield you throw it, the more likely you are to score, or whether you use expected points added or points on that drive or whatever. Deep balls are what makes teams score. So if it were the case that a bunch of 4-yard passes were turning into a bunch of 20 or 30-yard passes, talking about yards down the field, then yeah, we would expect offenses to become more efficient, as well as even the decision to run the ball versus pass the ball in the first place. There's a huge gap between those.
So just to give people listening to this an idea, as of right now, there are 9 quarterbacks whose average air yards per throw is at 9.5 or higher. And last season, only 6 quarterbacks finished at 9.5 or higher. One of them was Drew Stanton. One of them was Tom Savage. So, So if you look at last year, like guys like Fitzpatrick's average ADOT on a throw last year in those games he started was 8.9. This year it's at 12.5. So, yeah. or actually just straight, or 10.5 rather. Either you guys want to guess what Mahomes' is?
I think I saw this earlier, so I'm not going to guess. I'll let Danny do this.
Is it something in like 14 or something?
So this is those ones include throwaways or passes that like the receiver gives up on. The one on NFL.com I think is only intended air yards, so it's 12.1. But that's insane. That's like a better average depth of target than like most wide receivers have.
I love that.
Yeah,
anything over 10 yards is really, really deep. So 12 is huge. Andrew Luck's at like 5 or something. So
Luck is the lowest. He's the lowest of any quarterback through 2 games. He is currently checking down more than Derek Carr, Sam Bradford, Blaine Gabbert, Alex Smith, Trubisky. Like it's bad.
I saw a stat. I think Lombardi tweeted this out. I haven't confirmed it, but I want to say against the Steelers, who were a very good defense last year. Mahomes and Chiefs had 5 third downs total in that shootout.
That is actually what it tells you.
I mean, the secret to American gridiron professional style football is that third downs are bad and you should avoid them at whatever cost.
Yep.
Like I think play callers that realize that getting to third and two even is bad. Like third and two, technically you would have a success rate on each of those first 2 plays, but it's still not a play you want to be running.
I get anxiety whenever, I'm a Seahawks fan and Seahawks are notoriously bad at third down, but I get anxiety anytime any team like plays for third down. It just bothers me so much.
Yeah, well, I'm a Cowboys fan, so they're just like, they're playing for the 4th and 6th punt.
Hey, for Seahawks fans, we're happy to watch punts. That's the one. That's the happy part of the game.
I don't care which one of you does it, but I need one of you to explain to me the whole story with this punter. Because I will say, as a non-Seahawks Twitter person, we don't really get it the whole way. So I need someone to break it down for me.
Ben, you go.
So I can give you my whole punting story. So this all started back in early April when the Raiders released Marquette King. So I was kind of playing with the EPA data, looking at punting expected points added, which it sounds like an extremely nerdy thing to do during the off season. But so I was looking at this and I was comparing Marquette King's expected points added to Derek Carr's. And it turned out that on a per play basis, Marquette King was more valuable to the Raiders than Derek Carr.
Oh, no.
So I tweeted this out as like a ha-ha-ha, what are the Raiders doing thing. And then, of course, like 3 weeks later, the Seahawks trade up to draft the punter in the 5th round, and Seahawks analytics Twitter kind of loses their mind. But then preseason starts and he's like actually hashtag amazing. He's doing these like 60-yard punts that roll out of bounds inside the opponent's 5-yard line. Yeah. And then in Denver, which is of course a huge advantage for a kicker playing, but he averaged like close to 60 net yards per punt. And Football Outsiders had this article that argued that you can make a case that it was the best display of punting we've seen in the past few decades for a rookie kicker in his very first game.
Yes.
And since there's not really anything else going for the Seahawks, then this is this one thing we have. The DVOA banners they're hanging, but they're not going to be added to. So might as well lean into having this really good punter, because that's all there is.
So is, like, I will say this then, Danny, do you have like a counterpoint to that being like, well, at the end of the day, he's still a punter? Or is this like, why aren't more teams like recruiting soccer players to come be a, like, right. If this is a market inefficiency, you wouldn't have to, like, if you wanted to take an MLS player and be like, look, we'll pay you $500,000 every year to just learn how to be the best at this, that's truly a drop in the bucket and like a veteran's minimum. But for an MLS player, that's 90 times more than they would make on a yearly level. So why are more teams not trying to cultivate this?
This might actually make that happen, honestly. I think, well, number one, and I think that Justice Muscade is the one who always says this, but the draft is 4 rounds long. I literally don't care what teams do 5th round or on, because the hit rate on those, rate on those picks is like 5% or something like that. Like,
yeah.
That's the time to do it. And so the pick didn't bother me. It was funny at the time that they traded up for a punter, but like that doesn't actually bother me. I don't think it's a waste, because I mean, especially now that we've seen what he can do, and I actually hadn't looked into punters in the draft before the draft. And when they picked him, I was like, okay, what's the deal with this guy? And then I had so many people hitting me up about how freaking amazing this guy is. And then you see it, like, he, and John Schneider said it too, like on the night of the drive, he's like, wait till you see the things he does with his balls. And it was, but like, he literally like mixes like the spin of the ball with like a huge leg. And like, he literally just coffin corners it almost every time. It's insane. He's got crazy command with the football. So I don't know. I think number one, paired with the fact that it was a 5th round pick, right? It was a 5th rounder, right? I think, yep. Yeah, yep. It doesn't bother me where they took him. I think he does fit almost perfectly the Pete Carroll kind of philosophy of playing the field control game. And so that makes a ton of sense. And I mean, maybe this is the next market efficiency, really, is like finding this punter that can flip the field. Cause like we saw in the first game, he literally kicked from like the 15 yard line and it landed on like the 5, like he flipped the field.
Yep.
I mean, that should be, like, the fact that NFL teams haven't already been trying to, like, develop people to do that is just shows, like, how, like, they have to literally see it work before they decide to dedicate resources to it. Like, that's, like, the definition of how bad some of these teams are.
Yeah. He was the MVP of a bowl game.
That's
have you ever heard of that?
That's really wild.
Yeah. For a major conference team. So anyways.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a minute to tell you about my friends over at PowerHourDFS.com. They have an entire suite of daily fantasy sports tools to help you set your lineups this season. You know, they have all the tools that you've come to expect from a tout site. They have a lineup optimizer with floor, median, and ceiling projections. They also have some unique tools that help quantify injuries to an offensive line or provide advanced metrics and route data around a wide receiver versus a specific cornerback matchup. They have college football daily fantasy information, which not every DFS site does have. You can get their entire suite of tools along with a game-by-game analysis for every slate, showdown specific content, a cheat sheet with cash and GPP rankings, matchup data, betting content from yours truly, and much more every week from PowerHourDFS.com. And if you use the promo code MATTEK, MATTEK at checkout, you can save $20 off of your subscription. So Ben, speaking of you doing math and also, you know, teams not really realizing something until they see it happen, you've done a ton of work on why it's not efficient to run and why you're better off doing a bunch of play action, why you're better off throwing it deep. We've had Josh Hermsmeyer on the show. We've had a lot of similar conversation about all of it. And I think at this point, people listening to the podcast, they get it. You should throw the ball and not run the ball. But I actually see a trend where NFL teams are not running as often, but what they're doing, specifically in the case of McCaffrey, Melvin Gordon, and even Saquon Barkley, is they're just giving these dudes like 10 to 12 targets a game and just treating those like rushing attempts. Like for the first time, really using passes to get like 4 yards instead of running, you know, halfback dives.
Yeah, we talked about Percy Harvin earlier and how many targets he got, and I think this is kind of a similar thing. And the question is whether these short passes are displacing rush attempts, which it kind of seems like they are, versus whether they're displacing longer pass attempts. And if teams are, instead of running the ball, they're throwing the ball to running backs, then that's definitely a plus expected value play. So we know that rushing is very inefficient. Every rush attempt makes you, well, not every rush attempt. On average, a rush attempt makes you less likely to win the game, yet teams still stubbornly do it a lot of the time. So for teams that are running less often and instead of funneling targets to their running backs, then that has the potential to be a benefit. But it's not always, like, it doesn't always work. I think Saquon Barkley had like 28 receiving yards on 9 targets or something, and that's really not any better.
No, than no, he had he had 16 targets.
So if that's what it's like, and I think there were some McCaffrey games like that last year too, it seems like teams are still figuring out what actually works, and it can't just be like throwing it to the flat every time and hoping that they make a guy mm-hmm. miss, because if you do that over and over again, then NFL defenses are pretty good, and that's usually not going to work unless they're an Alvin Kamara just absolutely amazing.
It's funny that we're talking about this, because I'm literally writing about it today. And
thanks. Give us the preview.
So I went back and watched I watched all the targets for McCaffrey, Barkley, Kamara, and I want to say Gurley and Johnson today.
No, and Johnson, it would be like 3 targets.
Yeah. I watched all his targets for this year because basically they've just used him only on like these little quick release, like dinky dunk passes. And so, yeah, like I totally agree with what Ben was saying, you know, almost to a T. It was just like, on one hand, you like that they're kind of trying to get the ball out into space. And I think that was kind of the idea with Barkley. And we saw he's like really good at breaking tackles. You get him out into space and maybe something will happen. And rather than like running him into like a loaded box kind of thing. But at the same time, I think where you see this explosion in running back targets and catches, it's not necessarily like a better thing, because there's still like the vast majority of the routes I watched today from this week and from week one were just like the garden variety dump off. You know what I mean? Like, you know, just a little out route, a little quick route. You know, Gurley, I think, is a little bit different because they use him on screens really well. And so he has this explosive potential when you give him the ball in space. Kamara was, you know, I think he was kind of the most impressive of the group because they were using him on sort of quote receiver routes more often, you know, where he's running like basically what slot receivers would run versus rather than like you see a lot of like the McCaffreys and Barkley just run to the middle of the field and stop and then wait for a right. dump off, you know, and that's fine for a quarterback because that's helpful in certain situations, but I don't want teams to make that like the centerpiece of their offense, because then there's not really any different than running in some sense. But yeah, so that's kind of like, that's a long-winded way of saying it just kind of depends on what kind of routes you're asking.
Like Kamara routes are good to me, yeah. but yeah. Melvin Gordon routes where he has like his average depth of target is literally negative. It's behind the line of scrimmage. That's right. not so good. Although it is good because Melvin Gordon is not very good running the ball, but he's more likely to get you 4 yards with that than he is with a rush.
Right. And I mean, I think a lot of these plays are sort of constraint plays and where you're, Like, if you're giving a guy 16 of the same, like, those targets in a game, is it no longer becomes a constraint. Like, the defense loading up for that. So you have to, like, counter that. You know what I mean? And so I think it's just, like, you got to find a happy medium. And I really hope that teams decide to use Barkley, like, for instance, the Giants use Barkley as, like, more like the way that Kamara is used as, like, a slot receiver. He's running, like, two-way goes over the middle of the field, that kind of stuff, because he could be deadly that way. But right now, it's like basically just dump offs.
I've been thinking a lot about what the next wave of like kind of formation and personnel will be. I've been reading all these books about football. I read Blood, Sweat, and Chalk by Tim Layden.
That's good. Yeah.
It's a great book. And one that kind of just came out was Perfect Pass by S.C. Gwynn, which was about the birth of the air raid offense. Mm. Hal Mummy. I don't know if either of you guys have heard of him. But he was the guy who, he didn't invent the mesh offense, but he was the one that made it like more than just something that you ran a couple times a game. Like the BYU guys invented it and they would run it, you know, four or five times a game, but he ran it as like their base personnel. And it got me thinking, like, I think the next wave of like truly innovative play calling and offensive formations will be not creating a distinguishing positional label between running back and wide receiver, and being able to run a hurry up offense where you move, you know, number 82 into running back and you move number 30 out to not the slot, but like straight up like the Z position. And I guess my question is that actually feasible? Are these guys talented enough to like be able to play multiple positions? Like, do you think if Alvin Kamara was like, they were like, okay, you're going to get five targets a game as a straight up wide receiver, would he be good enough to allow that role to happen?
I think so.
Yeah. I think there's plenty of running backs who could do that if they were asked. Christian McCaffrey did a bunch of that in college. The Panthers maybe haven't used him as well. There's Kamara, Johnson, Gurley. If CJ Procise were healthy, he could do that. So it's just a matter of having people who are flexible enough to do both. And if that became how NFL offenses ran, then more people would be pushed to do that earlier in their careers as well. So I think that could happen. And this also connects with this theory that I've heard, which is that like the end result of football will be like always walking to the line of scrimmage with a pass play called and then only audibling to a run if the box count is in your favor. And this,
I mean, that's how like every like Big 12 offense does that.
Yeah. And Josh Hermsmeyer, who's been on the show, his work certainly supports that, where box count plays a large role in the success of a rush play. So if the deck is stacked against you, why would you choose to do that? Especially on first and 10 or second and long.
I think the Broncos are a good example of this year. And I'm going to pull up some numbers I have on this, because right now, if you look, and this is before Monday Night Football, but Philip Lindsay is number 3 in the NFL right now in running. Yeah. 178 yards, 6.1 yards per attempt. Matt Breida is first in the NFL, 184 yards, 8.4 yards per attempt, including like an insane, like 7 or 8 yards per carry on first down. And both of those guys are like 190 pounds. And I think the point being, what Ben is exactly saying is that like you have to manipulate the box count. And I saw this stat from Brandon Gadula from Number Fire. Royce Freeman has faced a loaded 8-plus defender box 56% of the time, whereas Philip Lindsay has faced it only 24% of the time he's carried the ball. And so like you can just explain the difference in their yards per attempt in that alone.
Well, right? you can also explain the difference in the number of defenders they face in the box based on opposing teams know what's about to happen when Royce Freeman is in the game. They know they know it's very unlikely that Royce Freeman is about to run a wheel route. But whereas like Philip Lindsay, like it's honestly 50-50 if it's going to go to him or if he's going to be used as a receiver.
Yeah. So I think that there's like two categories of, and like you said, at some point there's going to be like no real names, but like you have like the David Johnsons, the Todd Gurleys, Le'Veon Bell, that kind of category of a 220, 230 pound guy who can be a receiver and a running back. And then I think there's going to be a bunch of Kamara you know, clone, not clones, because he's a very special player, but like guys like him who are very fast can kind of do it both. And like Philip Lindsay and Breida are kind of like the poor man's version of that, maybe. And I think you'll see a lot of that kind of going forward too.
There definitely is like some traditional sort of bias against people that size. Cause I got into an argument with Michael Salfino, who I co-own a team with in this high stakes league. And let me tell you, co-owning a team with him is, it's an amazing experience, because every move I want to make, I have to have a case for it. And one of them was, I was like, yes, Alfred Morris is worth a pickup, but Breida is going to be the guy. And if you actually look, like, last 15 years in the NFL, there's really no one Breida's size and height
right. Who
has had, like, if you, like, make the threshold 110 carries and 50 targets. There's been, like, almost no one, because guys who are 195 pounds don't get 150 carries. Coaches mm-hmm. they just don't let it happen. So I had to take the L on that one. And Morris will have a role. But I definitely think part of what keeps these guys, like part of what keeps Alvin Kamara as just a running back, has been his coaches. And I actually think Sean Payton has these big downfalls as a play caller, but I actually think they are using Kamara optimally. Like, I think right. A lot of people would be like, why is Gillislee in there getting carries? But I actually think that Kamara is being used to the best use of his skill set. Ben, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, they probably don't want to funnel him a million carries, because he is so valuable, and putting that mileage on him is probably not the best. But they've done a really good job of getting him in places where he's on the open field. And then once he gets there, he's just like indescribably good. I don't know how he does it, but he is so good once he gets there.
He is. And so now we're to the portion of the show where we act like we know more than people who run NFL teams, which is my favorite thing to do on the internet. So the three of us are granted the job as a GM triumvirate over an expansion NFL team. I actually have not done this on the show before, which is surprising, because it's my favorite sort of thinking to indulge in. But what positions are we prioritizing in the draft and in our expansion picks? Like, obviously I think quarterback first, but what would you say number two position to target?
I would say probably left tackle.
I think we might all have a different answer. What about you, Danny?
Yeah, I was going to say, I was just picturing Joey Bosa. So I was going to say like a pass rusher.
And I was going to say, corner.
Yeah.
I was going to say like Casey Hayward, Marcus Lattimore, Patrick Peterson. Cause I actually think there's such a gigantic schematic advantage in taking away 25% of the field from your opponent. And pass, I would say for me, it would be cornerback, edge rusher, left tackle. So you have to defend your ranking, Ben.
Yeah, I kind of don't feel good about it already. So, but I guess this is partially just from watching the Seahawks for so long, where.
This is an emotionally scarred answer.
Yeah, that is certainly the case. So they had, in Pete Carroll's first draft, they drafted Russell Okung at 6 overall. He was there through 2015, and then they let him walk with no replacement. And they were basically playing with replacement level players at left tackle. And I think it was very damaging for Russell Wilson's development and the offense as a whole. It's really hard when you're constantly worried about getting free rushers from your blind side. And having Dwayne Brown has just made it look so much different. But all that said, I don't think there's any case that you should go left tackle before cornerback. So I have already been owned on this podcast.
Wow. And Danny got dumped on too, because you passed up edge rusher. So Danny, why did you say edge rusher over cornerback?
Oh, just the fact that, I mean, it's always so hard to like separate. I'm just thinking about the Jaguars for instance. Like, they've got these great cornerbacks, but how do you separate their play from the ability of the defensive line to like basically force quarterbacks to pass the ball extremely quickly? You know what I mean? Like, at some point, any quarterback that's given time is going to find an open guy.
The edge with the Jacksonville corners specifically is that they are really good at forcing opposing quarterbacks to throw short, which I think is a huge edge. That's what those two do really well to me.
So I don't have like a strong preference. Like if we had Lattimore versus like a good edge rusher on the board, like I wouldn't probably like pound the table for one guy or the other. But I do think the ability to like make a quarterback uncomfortable is going to help your corners a lot too. You know what I mean?
You can get by better with a cornerback rotation if the quarterback is getting pressured like every drop back. That's probably true.
Yeah. And so, I mean, just look at the worst defenses in the NFL have no pass rush, I guess. I think you could probably say the same about corner. They're so connected. It's just really hard to separate it.
What do you think of the argument that you can scheme around a pass rusher by getting the ball out early, but you can't really avoid a good cornerback?
Well, and if you also, this is like, no, I've never heard anyone make this point, but so the Giants game against the Jaguars, I mean, how much of their practice time do you think that they devoted installing plays to get Odell in the slot and on the move? Because he didn't do that against the Cowboys. That was a week one specific game plan that they had to take time out to do that. Like if they played the Jaguars in week 9, they would not have done that because it's too hard to do that in the middle of the season.
Yeah, it's so tough. I mean, I think you could make the argument that, yeah, you can scheme away from a pass rusher or you can scheme away from a corner. It's kind of like, I feel like it's kind of the same thing. You're basically taking sections of your playbook out based on a player, right? Right. So like, for instance, if you have a really good pass rusher, you're probably going to try and take as many of the really deep drops out of your playbook, right? Because you don't want to have your quarterback subject to Aaron Donald or whatever, you know? And so I think that, you know, there's arguments both ways. And to me, like, I think it does say, like, we have some sort of consensus that both corners and pass rushers are super important. The other thing that I'm kind of wondering is, like, how important a guy like Earl Thomas is in the middle of the field who can kind of do the same thing, like, take away the deep middle.
I mean, you definitely, safety play is certainly important, but I would want safeties after corners for sure. Mm-hmm. Cause they just come into the play so much less frequently.
Right. Right.
So in terms of, let's say all 32 teams probably protect their quarterback, which means that we have like 64 backups and third stringers to choose from. Like what archetype are we going for? Are we just trying to get, you know, Tom Savage, Brock Osweiler and win 6 games? Or do we want to do something like, if you wanted to win games right away in the first season, are you doing like the Taysom Hill, Terrell Pryor like rotation?
Oh man.
I would watch that team.
I think I would hate that. I would hate having to trying to figure that out. I don't know.
That's like a real hard thing. And we'd have the first pick in the draft, so we could take, you know, whatever quarterback there is, which is probably the right answer.
Yeah, I definitely would prioritize like a good quarterback, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's like an easy quarterback answer. And then get him killed with the expansion team offensive line.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to build a team, right?
Yeah, it's really hard. This next question is about that though. Are teams missing something with offensive line evaluation? Like, is there an inefficiency in like getting guys who played together in college or like keeping guys, like, for example, I actually think this is a discussion that a lot of teams would have is they've had a unit together 2 or 3 years and they're okay, not great. And one of the guys' contracts is up and the option is to either draft someone to replace them or sign someone in free agency. Is there value in just keeping the unit together, even if it's only okay, just because so much of offensive line play is about cohesion?
I think the answer is yes. And I'm pretty sure that Football Outsiders builds this into their projections where it's something like returning starters on the offensive line or continuity or something like that. I haven't seen a formal test of like whether this improves predictive power over the following season, but even on simple things like picking up stunts and handing off defenders and recognition, like it certainly would make sense that having guys that have played together for a long time would make a difference. And then if somebody gets hurt or departs, then you would expect a drop off after that, even if the player replacing him was just as good.
I kind of like, so I think any offensive lineman that you'll talk to will really strongly say it helps to have like sort of the nonverbal communication. I kind of like liken it to the difference between teams, like a basketball team, you've played together, AAU, high school, coming up, like you've played together for years, versus like what a team looks like when you just go play like pickup basketball. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
There's just an incredible difference between like what guy, like, you know where your guy is going to be, you know where blah, blah, blah. Like all that stuff is cliche, but at the same time, it's really true. And Ben said like the simple stuff, like picking up a stunt, but like, when was the last time you saw a freaking Seahawks pick up a stunt, like clean?
That's what I was thinking of.
So like, it's not simple. It's like, that stuff is really hard in the heat of the moment when, you know, you're going up against like, you know, Aaron Donald and freaking Sue. Like, those guys are moving really fast. You have to be able to like trust the guy that is next to you is going to pick up your guy. And so you can move off to the other guy, because if he doesn't, you're the one that looks bad. You know what I mean? And so it's just like, I think that stuff is real, even though it's like kind of a cliche to talk about like, oh, cohesion, but like, I think it's legitimate. The thing that came to mind when you mentioned like what teams are missing is, I don't know if necessarily teams are missing this, but there does seem to be like a little bit of a advantage with taking players, even if they're maybe not quite as talented, but like from Wisconsin or, you know, one of the quote pro style college teams, that like the offensive line factory teams, because just like, even if they're not as talented, they understand like what NFL teams are going to ask them.
And they know their job. They can get in and do their job.
Yeah. Like, they might not be the best blocker, the most athletic, but you know, I think you can just plug and play them a little bit more. I mean, look at Ryan Ramczyk with the Saints. I think most people kind of laughed that the Saints took him at that point, because they already had like a pretty solid offensive line, but I mean, he came in and they like really used him, and that was like the offensive line was a big part of their foundation last year. So I don't know. I think that could be, I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily that nuanced, because it's kind of obvious, but you know, I've seen a lot of teams take high, you know, potential guys or whatever, like really talented physical guys, but they just can't figure out how to block.
Yeah, I mean,
when you put it that way,
you've seen the Seahawks like take like nose tackles and be like, all right, you're a guard now.
Yeah, we were really excited about that stuff like a few years ago, but it didn't really work out how everyone was picturing it.
Yeah, so the last team building question is, we gotta hire coaches, obviously, to sort all this out for us. And you know, I think something that McVay doesn't get enough credit for is being like, hey man, I don't know anything about defense, so I'm gonna completely turn this over to someone who knows a bunch about defense. So who are we hiring for head coach, and are we making them care at all about defense, or are we just hiring an offensive coach to call the plays?
Ben?
Yeah, so, Ben, you gotta attack this.
So I think this is the general question is really interesting, which is, how do you hire somebody in a field that you're not an expert in? So like, if you're, well, none of us are offensive or defensive coaches. So even if we hired an obvious choice that, so I would definitely hire somebody who had an offensive mind. I think offense is, it's more stable and predictable over time. So if you're going to be a good team for an extended period of time, it's probably because you have a good offense for that time. So I would prioritize the offense, make the offensive guy the head coach, like the Rams or 49ers, and then hope they, or I guess we're the GM, so hope we can identify somebody who actually has a track record of improving defensive performance. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of Wade Phillipses out there with such a strong track record, but I think that is probably the model. I think, not to completely derail the answer, but I think one of the interesting things is how, so NFL teams are being given this huge amount of data, and general managers are not equipped to analyze it themselves, obviously, but they need somebody to do it. So how do they identify people who are competent in that in a way that helps them get a competitive advantage? Like, how do they even know who to hire? And that is a question that I just have no idea how to answer.
Well, the Chargers have no idea, because they do not have one person employed in their analytics department.
That's pretty bad.
I wonder if I wonder if that question is why we see so much nepotism in the NFL.
I would actually, I've never thought of it before, but yeah, like when you're faced with like literally thousands of choices, the easiest thing to do is hire someone you know.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Like my dad worked with him, which is like what you see so much.
That's how, do you know how the Seahawks have their analytics staffer? It's because Pete Carroll worked with his dad in the 1980s on the Vikings.
There you go.
And
I know that Schottenheimer's, Schneider worked with Schottenheimer, the elder Schottenheimer, I think. Yeah. So, yeah.
If you ask any coach how they got their job, pretty much it's going to be somehow they knew someone or their dad knew someone. Like reading all these books about football coaches has made me realize like it's literally all you knew somebody or your dad knew somebody.
Yeah. I like the model, and I know this happens probably a lot and it happens all everywhere, but again, it's going back to McShay, but like he started out as a player and then he got into coaching and then he cut his teeth with like, you know, very successful, very, very successful coaches. And he kind of just came up, worked his way up. And I think it's almost, I don't know how many guys.
He's like 3 years older than me and I'm a kid.
It's insane. But I mean, like, just think about McShay or his, not McShay, McVay. Think about his kind of like resume with the people that he's worked with. And like, I just think finding guys that have gotten a nice mix of philosophies and things like that is key. But I mean, that I guess you could probably say most coaches have that. So I don't know how much that helps.
He literally went from being an assistant tight ends coach in 2010 to being a straight up OC in 2014. That's a rise.
Yeah.
And then a really good head coach in 2017.
And he was an offensive coordinator for the Virginia Destroyers in 2000. No, I take that back. He was a quality control coach for the Florida Tuskers in 2009.
What even is that? Was that Arena League?
I mean, it's some league. The UFL, the United Football.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Danny, what's your team building answer?
What's my team building? What do you mean?
Like, do you prioritize the offensive mind or the defensive guy?
Yeah, I know who out of the 32 head coaches who don't currently have a job, I know who I'm hiring. It's Mark Trestman. I'm giving him another shot.
Really?
I think his ideas were good, and I think he would I think he would take all these like legit spread offensive stuff, and I think and like he's a coach in the CFL now and he has Bethed McLeod Thompson tossing the ball around the yard like a stud. Like I think he could do it.
I think I definitely lean offensive coach. I think that the head coaching position is kind of unique though. I think like if you look at Belichick or even Pete Carroll, they're more like CEOs than.
Yeah. Belichick doesn't call plays.
Yeah. And so it's kind of like difficult to answer that question. Like, cause both Carroll and Belichick are both defensive coaches, but they don't really like coach anything at this point. They're more like CEOs. So I think I do lean, and I agree with Ben and you, I think the offense is just more important at this level, at this stage in the game. So many rules are tilted towards the offense, and we've seen like the power of a good offense. I just think it's very, very difficult to build a defense that will last very long. And so, I think I would like prioritize finding a very smart offensive minded coordinator or coach who understands the ability to attack the entire field. I know that's like very basic, but like utilizing space and geometry to exploit a defense.
Ben, give me a name.
Mike Leach.
That's the second best answer to Mark Trestman.
I really wish we could see what would happen if he just got to run an NFL team. I think it'd be fascinating. It might fail spectacularly, but at least we know.
I want to like reach out to like his secretary or something to try and interview him and Hal Mummy. I'm like actively trying to reach out to both of them. I no promises anyone listening to this that I ever get them on, but I am trying to have conversations with both of those dudes, because I think it would, those are the guys who have said, well, what would happen if we passed 80 times in a game? They've actually done it.
Right.
And I want to hear from them. What was that, Danny?
I was going to say, like, Lincoln Riley is kind of a hot name these days in terms of someone.
He would never return my email, but I think Mike Leach might.
There you go.
That's a great way to end the show, comparing Mark Trestman to Bill Belichick and talking about me not getting emailed back. Ben, tell the people where they can find your work.
I write for The Athletic Seattle. Hopefully tonight's game won't be too depressing. And yeah. I'm also on Twitter at Ben B. Baldwin. And thanks for having us.
Danny, your turn.
Yeah, I write for The Ringer. And I just realized that we both have Twitter handles with like a B in the middle. Danny B. Kelly is my Twitter handle. And yeah, I just look at my stuff on The Ringer.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.